Psalm 28. To you I will cry, O Lord my rock. Do not be silent to me, lest if you are silent to me, I become like those who go down to the pit. Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry to you, when I lift my hands toward your holy sanctuary. Do not take me away with the wicked and with the workers of iniquity, who speak peace to the neighbors, but evil is in their hearts. Give them according to their deeds and according to the wickedness of their endeavors. Give them according to the work of their hands. Render to them what they deserve, because they do not regard the works of the Lord nor the operation of his hands. He shall destroy them and not build them up. Blessed be the Lord, because he has heard the voice of my supplications. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusted in him, and I am helped. Therefore, my heart greatly rejoices. With my song, I will praise him. The Lord is my strength, and he is the saving refuge of his anointed. Save your people and bless your inheritance. Shepherd them also and bear them up forever.
Thank you, Steve. We're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 18 today for our primary text. So if you want to turn there to 1 Samuel chapter 18. First Samuel 18, verse 1 says, "Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women that had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s.' Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?' So Saul eyed David from that day forward. And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand, as at other times. But there was a spear in Saul's hand, and Saul cast the spear, for he said, 'I will pin David to the wall.' But David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people, and David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, 'Here is my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles.' For Saul thought, 'Let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.' So David said to Saul, 'Who am I, and what is my life from my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?' But it happened at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Meholathite as a wife. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, 'I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.' Therefore Saul said to David a second time, 'You shall be my son-in-law today.' And Saul commanded his servants, 'Communicate with David secretly and say, Look, the king has delight in you and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law.' So Saul's servant spoke those words in the hearing of David, and David said, "Does it seem to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing I am a poor and lightly esteemed man?" And the servants of Saul told him, saying, "In this manner David spoke." Then Saul said, "Thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies." But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. So when the servants told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now the days had not expired, therefore David arose and went, he and his men, and killed 200 men of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full count to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul became David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war, and so it was, whenever they went out, that David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. There are two very interesting things about this passage, if you didn't notice. One is that David behaved how? Consistently, it says, very wisely. It marks him out as that. But one thing that we continue to see throughout this passage, which may be more the emphasis by the writer, may be Saul in this passage. That being him in his jealousy towards David, the resentment that grew and the jealousy over what he was fearing to lose. It's interesting to look up, what is jealousy, right? What is jealousy? Well, we have all probably experienced jealousy, but how would you define it? I looked online to see different quotes on it. One quote, probably one of the best quotes on jealousy, is this: "I'm not jealous, I'm envious. Jealousy is when you worry someone will take what you have. Envy is wanting what someone else has. What I feel is envy." That's Homer Simpson. He was quoted as saying that. But actually, that's very concise, a very good way of putting it. Dr. Gary Collins in 1985, very much in the same way, said these words: "There is a distinction between jealousy and envy. To envy is to want something which belongs to another person. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, his wife or his servant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. In contrast, jealousy is the fear that something which we possess will be taken away by another person. Although jealousy can apply to our jobs, our possessions, or our reputations, the word more often refers to anxiety which comes when we are afraid that the affections of a loved one might be lost to a rival. Perhaps it's affections, perhaps it's something like influence. We fear that our mates, or perhaps our children, will be lured away by some other person who, when compared to us, seems to be more attractive, capable, and successful." Jealousy is nothing new, is it? Even when we look in the garden, we see beyond that in Genesis early on with the brothers, Cain and Abel, it would seem that there's jealousy over God accepting the gift of Abel and not accepting Cain's gift. And what that produced was obviously murder. But today the word that you might want to throw in with jealousy is foolishness. The Bible uses the word many times in the Old Testament for foolishness, correct? But foolishness is when we are not acting in line, not acting in wisdom whatsoever. It's the opposite of acting in line with wisdom, with what is correct and accurate. It is acting on our own, for our own ends, outside of what God would have. And one thing you will note about your own jealousy that I should note about mine is that when we are in the throes of it, we rarely ever think we're being foolish, right? No one's ever really angry, and at the same time, in their deep anger, they're saying, "I'm such a fool for being so angry." People don't do that. They do it maybe after the fact when they calm down, but rarely in the moment do we feel like we're being foolish. And yet jealousy, scripturally, is just that. It is foolishness. Jealousy is condemned in the scriptures. God makes it quite clear, doesn't he? And yet he also says many times over, "I am jealous for my people," right? The jealousy of God is not the jealousy of man. God is right to be jealous for your affection, for my affection. He is right to want us to obey. He is right to not want to lose us to other gods, to false gods, to our own lusts. He is right to want that. So when it speaks of his jealousy, we always have to keep in mind it is not our jealousy. Our jealousy is often over the fear of losing things, but God is in control. He gives and he takes away. It is a sinful, selfish response to the fear of losing what one thinks they have to another. I think that we can see through those different definitions of it that it's the fear of losing what one thinks they have to another. Not just fear of loss, but fear of loss to someone, something. Often fueled by pride and entitlement and perhaps other thoughts, but jealousy is no friend to the believer. And we ought to learn that lesson from people like Saul in 1 Samuel 18. I really do think that that's one of the big lessons God's trying to teach you and me here today in 1 Samuel 18 is that jealousy can take you places you don't want to go. It can take you farther than you ever intended to go. And it can make you look like a fool in the end. We must guard against jealousy over lesser things than God. And today we're going to look at three ways that we can become enslaved, you might say, or unnecessary aspects to this jealousy. But I would say that slavery really is a big part of jealousy. In order that we might guard against it in our own hearts before God. And first of all, let's look at this. Jealousy is an unnecessary burden kept from God. You ever carried an unnecessary burden? You might consider these words Tony Evans told this years ago. It says, one day two monks were walking through the countryside. They were on their way to another village to help bring in the crops. As they walked, they spied an old woman sitting at the edge of a river. She was upset because there was no bridge and she could not get across on her own. The first monk kindly offered, we will carry you across if you would like. Thank you, she said gratefully, accepting their help. So the two men joined hands, lifted her between them, and carried her across the river. When they got to the other side, they set her down, and she went on her way. After they had walked another mile or so, the second monk began to complain. Look at my clothes, he said. They are filthy from carrying that woman across the river, and my back still hurts from lifting her. I can feel it getting stiff. The first monk just smiled and nodded his head. A few more miles up the road, the second monk griped again. My back is hurting me so badly, and it is all because we had to carry that silly woman across the river. I cannot go any farther because of the pain. The first monk looked down at his partner, now lying on the ground, moaning. Have you ever wondered why I'm not complaining? Your back hurts because you are still carrying the woman. I put her down 5 miles ago. A good point. Often we carry unnecessary burdens. And we see that Saul does this very much to this passage of carrying unnecessary burdens. Another story here, a fable of an eagle, which could outfly another, and the other didn't like it. The latter saw a sportsman one day and said to him, I wish you would bring down that eagle. The sportsman replied that he would if only, he only had some feathers to put into the arrow. So the eagle pulled one out of his wing. The arrow was shot, but didn't quite reach the rival eagle. It was flying too high. The envious eagle pulled out more feathers and kept pulling them out until he lost so many that he could no longer fly. At which the sportsman turned and killed him. This is what jealousy does to a person, carrying these unnecessary burdens. And I would add, if you see your notes there, kept from God. Because oftentimes, it's not that we don't get burdened emotionally by the things of life, but that we refuse to place them in the proper hands. We want to carry them, we want to talk them out, we want to hash them out, but we do not want to place them into God's hands and handle them correctly. And that is where we will fail. One thing we want to note here about Saul is that Saul's problem with David was Saul's problem with David. It wasn't David's problem that Saul had a problem with him. It was Saul's problem that Saul had a problem with him. And how do we know? Well, we can look through that passage. And first of all, we see that it starts with David and Jonathan were best friends. They were best friends. They were knit to each other in soul. Jonathan gave up his armor. Jonathan says that they're looking out for one another. Clearly, it was not a David issue here. But we see with them, no problem. Secondly, David and Michal. Recall that Jonathan was Saul's son, Michal was one of Saul's daughters. It says that they loved each other deeply. Numerous times throughout this passage, to say that if David was that much of a problem, then why did Saul's own family not have the same problems with him? You should ask that, right? You should ask that kind of question. If a person is that much of a problem, they tend not to be isolated to one person only, but tend to have that problem start to spring up with others. But we don't just see between Saul and his children and David, but we also see the people throughout this passage. The people, as well as the soldiers, they all highly esteem David. They all see him as wise. None of them has a problem. Everyone wants to follow him. And yet we see that the whole story changes when David comes walking into town. And it really wasn't even his fault, was it? It was the fault... Well, we could blame the people, the women, for singing, right? Saul might have blamed the women for singing. If you hadn't sang that David killed tens of thousands and me just thousands, I wouldn't have been mad. But that was just a trigger of a man who was already set up, who had a heart that had a major problem. And we might say here that he had emotional irresponsibility. All of these emotions, we don't always see jealousy for what it is. But how do we sense it when it's around? Well, there are a handful of ways it's described about Saul here that all go back to jealousy. First of all is anger. Anger. In Ephesians 26-27, as well as 31, it says these words: "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil." Now, it's interesting in that verse that it's saying that giving the place to the devil has a lot to do with holding on to anger. You could tie it to many things about you generically giving place to the devil, but in this verse, it is tying it to not resolving anger correctly. Secondly, in verse 31, "Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." And so we see that Saul's approach to his anger was very different. Rather than doing that in terms of dealing with it, Saul grabbed a spear. Saul put David in positions where he thought he might die on purpose. Unfortunately, you know this as well, that as you get down into David's story, David will use a play from Saul's own textbook, in a sense, won't he? He will put the man, the husband of Bathsheba out there on purpose to intentionally have him killed. But when you look at the scripture, Saul was actually quite a master of doing that very thing. Unfortunately, David chose to do that later in his life. But anger was one issue that Saul had, and he never resolved it appropriately. Secondly is displeasure. We see that in verse 8, that Saul was displeased. When God speaks to Cain and Abel, when he speaks to Cain, rather, in Genesis 4:6-7, it says these words: "So the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? Why the bad face? Why do you look the way you do and act the way you do? If you do well, verse 7, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it.'"
It's almost like an animal waiting to attack. You have got to take control with this. Cain would not. And Saul would not either with his own displeasure. They were both displeased, and they both chose to go a different direction. But God gave Cain an opportunity within that verse after he had already lost his pleasure in that. Distress, in verse 10, we see that Saul was distressed. He was given a distressful spirit from God. But you might even just translate that as stress in the new, you know, today. That's typically how we call it. Is stress. Psalm 18, verse 6 says this: "In my distress I called upon the Lord and cried out to my God. He heard my voice from his temple, and my cry came before him, even to his ears." David is saying, "I went with my stress to God." In the New Testament, in Philippians, we see that the call is: "Be anxious for nothing, but through everything in prayer and supplication, make your requests known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds." And so how do I get that peace? Well, I place it in his hands. How do I keep myself from being at peace? Well, I hold on to it, essentially, and carry it. Much like the monk who was still essentially carrying the woman. Finally, fear. This was one of the words used most about Saul in this passage. It's used in verse 12 and verse 15 and as well in verse 29. And it says in Psalm 27:1, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear?" Well, one answer might be many people. There's many people that might have a cause for fear in. And yet, he's ultimately, I have to see God is higher than all these others. "The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" It is a comparative verse between people and God, your situations and God. Which leads us to yet another aspect of this chapter, 1 Samuel 18, obsession. Obsession. You know what it is to obsess? Of course you do. To think continuously over the same thing. To focus all of your energy and attention on one place, one person. Sometimes it's not a bad thing that you're focusing on, but you are focusing on it too much. Sometimes it is a bad thing that you're focusing on. But obsession with the wrong party. It's not wrong to be obsessed with God, but that doesn't lead us to do wrong things. But as we obsess over other things, we find it changes us drastically. Two verses here that really point to that obsession is in verse 9, it says that Saul eyed David from that day forward. How long forward? It would seem, till the day Saul died, that Saul eyed David. He would chase him out all over the countryside. David would show him mercy. He would go back. He'd say, "I've done wrong." And what would he essentially do the next day when he woke up? Go back to chasing him. Because Saul was obsessed. Saul had no obsession with God. He had all obsession with David. Saul had already been told, by the way, that you were losing the kingdom. And yet Saul still held on to it. Throughout all these, until he died, he held on to a kingship that was taken away by God officially. Secondly, verse 29, because he became David's enemy continually. You should note that word continually in this verse because it's possible that we have moments of being enemies with other people. But with Saul, it is no longer momentary where he's okay with David and now he's not. The idea of being continually his enemy means he's consistently his enemy. That's all he is in his mind, is an enemy. And Saul has chosen to make him that. He has chosen to make David his enemy. Saul drifted further from God the more he obsessed with David, didn't he? If you read through these passages, 1 Samuel, as you go further in the book with Saul, you'll notice that Saul and God, they're not words that tend to be together in verses. Because Saul no longer really has time for it. At one time, Saul would ask God to bless his decisions after he made them. He doesn't even do that anymore. Saul will eventually, near the end of his life, go to seek a witch to conjure forth Samuel from the dead to ask, will he win in a battle? And you see what he's done, how far he has drifted. He is obsessed with David. He is obsessed with his holding on to his kingship. Obsession with others diminishes God to us as well. If you could draw something from this passage to hold on to, one thing I'd tell you is be careful about what you obsess over because it will rob you of God and his place in your heart. What you obsess over becomes a functional God to you in your heart. Whoever you obsess over, they will take that throne that God once may have had. And that is one of the reasons that it is great foolishness to be jealous, to live in jealousy. You carry unnecessary burdens that you keep from God. You may hold on to, you may have typical emotions to problems like we all do. But if you will hold on to them and not give them to God, you are carrying a burden that you don't need to carry, and that's foolish. Secondly, we see jealousy as the dishonorable actions done before God. Not just in my mind, which is where most of us can tend to keep jealousy, but it also starts to seep out, doesn't it, into our actions. For Saul, we see a few different ways that will come forth. But before I get into those, let me just say this from Jonathan Edwards, the preacher from the 17th century in America. He says, "Some persons are always ready to level those above them down to themselves, while they are never willing to level those below them up to their own position. But he that is under the influence of true humility will avoid both those extremes.
On the one hand, he will be willing that all should rise just so far as their diligence and worth of character entitle them to. And on the other hand, he will be willing that his superiors should be known and acknowledged in their place, and have rendered to them all the honors that are their due. Benjamin Franklin, around that time too, maybe a little later, would say, "It is the eyes of other people that ruin us. If all but myself were blind, I should want neither a fine house nor fine furniture." Interesting quote. I'll read it again. It is the eyes of other people that ruin us. Well, that's not quite true. It is your heart that ruins you. But their eyes, he's saying, you know, the fact that they focus on you. If all but myself were blind, I should want neither a fine house nor fine furniture. Dishonorable actions done before God, first of all, was in verses 10 and 11, where Saul begins his jealousy. Not after he first just gets angry that the song is going on and takes it to heart, but then as David comes with this distressing spirit upon Saul, Saul reaches for his spear to pin David to the wall, either to pin him or to kill him, but he wants to cause him harm. This is the overt violence. That doesn't work. David gets away from him. But we see that Saul's tactics begin to change. They become more passive in this passage, and yet they are still just as violent in their own right. They are covert. First of all is the promotion to cause demise. Saul wanted him to be the leader of the armies, not because that would make him great in the eyes of the people, but because he hoped that if I put you there, what will happen? You will die, and that will take care of my problem. Secondly, blessing him with his daughter, the promise of marrying his daughter as a snare, it says. As a snare, verses 21 through 27. He hoped that him going out to get those Philistine foreskins would result in him being killed. Of course he wanted that. Saul covered his intentions entirely. There is nothing honorable about that. There is nothing to be commended about that. But that is perhaps what we do. Obvious immaturity, we see him covering his intentions. It says in some versions his intent, some other versions will say his thoughts were to do this. He meant for this harm. He didn't make that clear, but he meant for it nonetheless. Verse 19, we saw that he actually had been promised, David had been promised the first daughter, Merab. You know that he was supposed to get that daughter, if you recall from the last chapter, 1 Samuel 17, whoever kills the giant will get three things. He'll get a tax-free life, essentially. He'll get lots of riches, and he will get what else? The daughter of the king. Saul did not fulfill his own promises to those to David in this passage. And so that is an aspect of yet his immaturity as well. But really, he was holding on to what God was taking away. Are you holding on to what God is taking away? An excellent question. One of the harder ones, I suppose. There are a few different examples in the scriptures that you might consider of those who handled the changing of guards, essentially, in a very different way. First of all, Numbers 11, 24 through 29, if you want to turn there with me. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, chapter 24, or 11, excuse me, chapter 11. If you do a yearly scripture reading, you very well may have gone over this passage recently, and that's, in my Bible, it has that, this last week. But verses 24 through 29 were very interesting. It says, so Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took of the spirit that was upon him and placed the same upon the 70 elders. And it happened when the spirit rested upon them that they prophesied, although they never did so again. But two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, the name of the other Medad, and the spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those listed, but who had not gone out to the tabernacle, yet they prophesied in the camp. And a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp.
So Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, "Moses, my lord, forbid them. This is a threat to you." Verse 29 tells us different, though. Moses said to him, "Are you zealous for my sake? Oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them." What a good response to that. I'm not threatened by this. I wish everybody was prophesying. I wish everyone was zealous for God this way. Sometimes even the zeal for God, someone gets a zeal for him and they feel like others who might have a zeal for him might be a threat to them. That's a terrible way of looking at other people, but it's a very possible way that you might do that. John chapter 3, verses 26 through 30. Now you've probably read John 3:16, obviously, but later in that book, we might look at those verses. John 3, 26 through 30. Actually, I have to start in verse 25. There arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification. And they came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, he who is with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, Jesus, behold, he is baptizing and all are coming to him." Do you hear what they're saying? Problem. They're going after him. John answered and said, "A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease." He must increase, but I must decrease. That's the appropriate response. That's what jealousy, what does looks like the opposite of jealousy, right? That's what it looks like. Philippians 1, 15 through 18. Paul will have this heart as well. And by the way, when Jesus comes into town on Palm Sunday, the Pharisees are quoted many times as saying, "You see, everyone's going after him. We've got to stop him." Jesus coming into town and raising Lazarus from the dead had much to do with the Pharisees freaking out and doing everything they could that week to bring his death about. That's the ungodly jealous response. Philippians 1, 15 through 18 says these words, "Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains. But the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice." He says, "I'm not going to get burned up about this. Even if they're being fake, even if they're doing this to hurt me, I'm glad the gospel's going forth, and I hope it backfires in some sense on them that people believe. They're doing it so that I'll get hurt and maybe people will get saved." Third and final today is this: jealousy equals incompatible hopes within the plans of God. Incompatible hopes. Give me just a minute to go back to 1 Samuel 18. A.W. Tozer said these words years ago, "Hope has sustained the spirit of many a shipwrecked sailor by painting for him a tender picture of rescue and reunion with loved ones, only to leave him at last to die of thirst and exposure on the vast bosom of the sea. Hope has kept many a prisoner believing he could not hang, that a pardon would surely come, and that stood calmly by and watched him die at the end of a rope. Hope has cheered 1,000 victims of cancer and tuberculosis with whispered promises of returning health, who were never again to know one single day of health till they died. Hope has told the mother that her son missing in action was surely alive and kept her watching till the end of her days for the letter that never came and that never could come because the boy that might have written it had been long sleeping in an unmarked grave on a foreign shore. Surely for the fallen sons of men, the Hindu proverb is true, there is no disease like hope." All that is to say, it's not so much hope is the problem, it's that you're hoping in the wrong things.
Oftentimes our prayers are for perhaps the wrong things. We want everything to be fixed and good and fine, and fail to see that God may have a point to allowing something negative to happen. You want it gone, you hope everything will go to normal with health or whatever it may be, and you're missing the lesson if that's all you hope for. You see, Saul had very incompatible hopes within the plans of God. He hoped that David would die. He hoped that David would just not be a problem for him any longer. He hoped, don't you think, let me ask you this question. What do you think Saul hoped for in his tombstone someday? Because if you really look at his life, I don't think it'd be surprising to say that he would want "Great King" written on his tombstone, even though God had ripped it away from him. Saul did not want to let go of that. David was part of the losing of that, and he knew it. And it says that quite clearly through this passage. But his intentions were unfulfilled. You see, Saul, what he wanted was not what God wanted. David was seen as wise more and more. Do you think Saul wanted that? With all that he did, he wanted David to look like a fool. And the last thing he wanted was for people to see his wit, him to be wise. But it happened. And what did that lead to? That led to him gaining more influence over those very people. As they saw him being wise and acting in wisdom, he gained influence. The very thing Saul did not want to happen. Saul would have been better off not touching him, not having him step up and lead the people, doing nothing, offering no daughter as a wife. But Saul thought that if he did those things, he would catch David and see to his demise. But rather, the rewards backfired, didn't they? And Saul's snares undid himself. They undid himself. You see, unbiblical hopes can lead us to isolation. They can. And how might we be isolated? We can be, like Saul, isolated in our fears. You see, you don't read about everyone else in this passage being afraid like Saul. Saul is the only one who is afraid in this passage of David. No one else sees David as a problem, but Saul does. And so he is in fear, and he's not going to tell anybody he's afraid. He's not going to make that clear. He's going to try to cover that. Secondly, isolation in intent. Nobody else is saying, we hope David goes down too. Saul had to cover that so that only Saul could try to get away with that, with his intentions. And hope no one figured it out, that he was promoting David so that David would be killed. Isolation from God. You see, he was not closer to God through this passage. The more that he moved in that direction of doing what he did to try to get at David, the less and less that he reached out to God, the more and more God seems like a distant memory to Saul. And as well, we also see isolation from God's people. Saul appears, long ago in this book, to be less and less connected to the people that he leads. He just seems to be here with his little throne, and he's with his close men. But out here are the people, and they're seeing David, and Saul is losing in the quiet recesses of the castle, whatever he was in. And so we see isolation tends to be what takes place with these incompatible hopes. Saul could not stop God's work, but he would not be supportive of God's plans. Maybe that's you. You cannot stop God's work, but you will not support God's plans. That is a horrible, foolish place to be. The best thing you can do is be on board with God as to what he is up to, and to try to be in sync with that. Even if your prayers don't get answered, even if it goes quite differently, it is more better to be on board with him than to keep trying to get him to come on board with you. There are three biblical principles, I think, that we can be helped with in dealing with the issue of jealousy, and I would just suggest these to you today. Number one is choose contentment. Choose contentment. Philippians 4, 11 through 13, Paul says, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound everywhere, and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Paul did not see people getting elevated and say, oh, they're a threat to me. He says, all things, God can lift me up, God can lower me. He can do whatever he wants, and he's right to do that, and I'm content with where he places me. You almost have to put some blinders on to other folks in their own situations. Number two is rehearse your identity.
Many of us are trying to find identities outside of Jesus, and that's part of the reason we're in so many problems that we are, is that we try to find identity in things that are not lasting. Galatians 2:20 says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. At the core of who I am, my identity is this: I am his. We are united. I am a believer. I am being made more and more in the image of Jesus to spend eternity with him. That is my identity, and I have to rehearse that identity, because if you don't, you're very likely to be influenced with other identities that you may try to find fullness in, fulfillment in. Number three is this, today as we close: cultivate wisdom and act accordingly. One thing about David throughout this whole passage of 1 Samuel 18 is that David was marked and known for being wise, wise, wise. That's what he was known for, was wisdom. Cultivate it. Pray to God. Ask him, God, help me to be wise. Grow me in my wisdom. Help me to live like that. Jerry Bridges says these words: the cure for the sin of envy and jealousy is to find our contentment in God. The cure for jealousy is to find contentment in God. It is to live in wisdom. It is to seek him, and it is to do what he wants and to follow suit with that. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word today. Thank you that we can look through it. I thank you for the lessons that it has for us. I pray, God, that you'd help us just to continue to grow and to be challenged within it, and also to seek it out, Lord, in understanding it better. And so, God, I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.